Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to One Broken Mom. Sometimes in this world of ours, we do encounter madness and monsters. And if we have grown up in environments where our sense of safety and survival has curried us to be ready for danger at all times, well, we end up looking for it whether we want to or not. And I don't mean that we walk around in life like Lara Croft Tomb Raider, armed and ready to take down the bad guys. No, it's more like we're the girl in the horror movie that everyone is yelling at, "No, don't run back into the house, stupid. What are you doing?" And because who's waiting for us in the house? That's right, the axe-wielding psychopath. Now, I know that's extreme, and I'm just trying to be lighthearted, but the truth is scarier than the horror movie fiction. There are psychopaths among us in our everyday lives, and sometimes for some people, they are so close to us, it's frightening once we know who they really are. But what is a psychopath? Are they only crazed murderers, violent criminals? Or are they always the obvious, aberrant members of our society? Or is the answer even more frightening than that? So I have today with me William Herstein. Bill is also a philosopher and a scientist, having published numerous scientific articles, including works on consciousness and sociopathy. And he's the author of several books, which I'll have the links at the end of it because they're amazing. They include Brain Fiction, Self-Deception and the Riddle of Confabulation, Mind Melding, Consciousness, Neuroscience, and the Mind's Privacy. And the latest one, which is the most exciting one for me, is Responsible Brains, Neuroscience, Law, and Human Culpability. So welcome to the show, Bill.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what everybody did not hear is this conversation we already started beforehand and me expressing my complete excitement at being able to jump into this topic with Bill today. And what I'd like to have you start us off with here is this concept of psychopathy and sociopathy. They're words that are kind of used interchangeably in our language. You know, where did this come from and how did these terms enter into culture in this field of psychology and studying the human mind and behavior?
Yeah, I think one good starting point here is get clear on the distinction between sociopathy and psychopathy, since it's bounced back and forth, especially during the 19th century. I'm using what I take to be the current usage, which is that psychopathy is a more severe, probably genetic condition. They tend to do worse stuff. Sociopaths might be formed more by, abusive upbringing, might be less genetic. There's definitely evidence for a genetic component to psychopathy, which is scary when you think about it, because it means that psychopathy is a successful evolutionary strategy, right? And it's managed to stay in the gene pool. But if you look at the history of when did people first start using these concepts, and what you'll find is that pretty much in every culture, they write about people who just don't care about other people and wind up abusing them. I was just reading about Native Americans have called certain males cougars because they're lone wolves, to mix a metaphor. As opposed to the rather communal style of living that they favor. And I bet if you looked at pretty much every culture, you would find people who fit that description, who tend to come to awareness when they, when they harm people.
So how do we find out or determine, if somebody would be labeled as a psychopath? Saying that you know, testing it. Because I think that one of the fears is that if you ask somebody if they're a psychopath, naturally they're going to say no, right? Because there's an art of deception to this. And so what is being used today that that maybe people don't know on how to actually make that distinction between, you know, just again, a sociopath, a person with just antisocial, you know, behaviors, and somebody that would truly be called a psychopath?
Yeah, the current scientific take is that there are three core factors. I was mentioning the thinking during the 20th century that sort of mentioned seven or eight interesting factors, but a lot of those sort of winnow down to these three factors, which you could describe as boldness, right? Which shows a form of confidence, assertiveness, disinhibition, in that they just don't seem to have the little qualms, the little gut feelings that keep us from doing unethical things. You know, because we all think about doing unethical things, but another part of the brain says, oh, don't do that, bad idea. And they either don't have that or they don't know how to integrate it into their thinking about their actions. And the last thing is just referred to as meanness, which is pretty self-descriptive. Just, you know, willingness to hurt people. Again, disconnection between emotion, in this case, empathy, and their higher level thought. You know, we take empathy into account in formulating actions and plans and things like that. They just don't. Mm-hmm. So some of this is based on fancy statistics. Another factor that doesn't get into the list of 3 years is sort of glib speaking, related to something else I work on called confabulation, a way of speaking where you don't really know what you're talking about, but you sound confident. You might not be lying because you might actually believe what you're saying. President Trump is interesting in this regard. Like, it's sort of unclear in the minds of everybody, you know, is the man lying? Does he believe what he's saying? And I think he's sort of slowly sliding along that continuum from actually lying, you know, which would involve knowing that you're saying something false. But he seems to believe what he's saying. Like when he talks about, you know, that how his inauguration was the best attended one ever, of course, which it was not. But when he speaks about that, he seems to believe it. And so that sort of reminds me of the way that sociopaths and psychopaths work, which, and, you know, if you believe what you're saying, you're all the more convincing when you do so.
Yeah, and that's actually probably one of the weirdest phenomenons I've ever witnessed, you know, in another person, is that right there, where, you know, there's a lot of making statements, but you're sitting there going, there's no facts behind those statements. Like there's no truth to that. And when you try talking to somebody who is really skilled and experienced with speaking in that manner, it's a frustrating situation to be in, because you can't do anything to alter their perception of what they believe there.
Yes.
I'm just going to ask this question. Is this something that they have learned to evolve and develop? Because it feels so, it's so natural that I don't even know if, and you do because you're the researcher here, but I mean, do they ever know, you know, that what they're saying is untrue? I mean, is there anything in there that tells them that, like, I know I'm about ready to say something that's totally untrue and can be proven, but I don't care? Or is it they just really have, they appear to have absolutely no idea that they just lied or spoke something that is, you know, invalid?
Yeah, I think maybe both cases apply. I think one thing that's happening is that, you know, if you or I were saying something untrue, we might be a little bit nervous. This relates to the notion that it might be hard to detect them using lie detection techniques, and that those rely on the person getting nervous. But, you know, if we got caught in a lie in public, we'd be deeply embarrassed and, you know, probably want to shrink from the situation. Whereas what happens with them, there's no guilt, no shame, no embarrassment. They just quickly tell another lie and keep moving. And I think at some level they know they're doing this. Notice this relates to how responsible they are for what they're doing, because if they don't know they're doing it, I suppose they're less responsible. You know, and if they know full well that they're lying and trying to deceive people, then they go much more over to the responsible side of that continuum. But, yeah, I think just this absence of a gut-level knowledge that you know you're saying something wrong, that's what makes us nervous. And that just seems not to happen in them. So, I think a lot of the average public goes around thinking that they can tell when they're being lied to and when they're not being lied to. And if you're one of those people, there's a sociopath or psychopath who would love to meet you, because if you're going by nervousness, it's just not going to work. They can lie, with complete calmness and confidence.
Yeah, and that's a frightening thought. I think, too, the other part of it is that then when what we now normally try to do when somebody, speaks a lie to us is, again, provide the facts, to prove that that's not actually the case, and that hope that we can guide them to go, okay, yeah, I admit it, I did it, I didn't mean to, and be able to get some resolution out of that. But when dealing with somebody who speaks that way all the time, that's almost like that's folly. Like there's no effort. You can't and to expend effort, but yet we try to expend effort trying to prove them out or to try to convince them. I'll put it that way. Trying to convince them to change their mind when in fact we may never be able to do that. How do we deal alternatively then with somebody, in that manner? I mean, just like in general, do we just ignore the lie and focus our energies on making sure the other people that need to know truth know it?
I think one good way to deal with it, assuming you can do this and you've got the time, is you've got to kind of nail them down, because if you catch them in a lie, they're going to try to quickly change the subject, and you've got to keep bringing them back to the subject and sort of rub their faces in it, which of course is going to make them angry, which may put you in danger. And then this anger response tends to be a pretty standard thing.
So if we're talking here about the kind of the core attributes of it, one of the things that you and I had mentioned and were discussing offline before the episode started was, what are some really good red flags for people, especially as you had mentioned, for women being able to identify men that have these psychopathic behavioral traits? Because, when people are listening to this episode, when it's published, I'll say that people listen to this all year round, but when it's published, this will be in October, which is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And because of the compelling personality and the persuasive personality that a psychopath can actually exhibit, they can lure in women into dangerous situations. So what do you think are some top level red flags for people to be aware of that, again, go beyond just being a jerk to being somebody that is actually emotionally and possibly physically dangerous?
Yes, I guess one of the first things you've got to do is sort of winnow out actual confidence from the sort of fake confidence that they exhibit. I think another thing to look for is sort of a total selfishness where they're just unable to conceive of the interests of other people. And I would think that's going to show up pretty quickly. The word egotistical shows up in the diagnostic criteria a great deal. I think it's easy to get swept away in their fantasies and things like that. I think, some psychopaths enter the business world and they get people to invest in shaky projects just because they're so convincing and so alluring. I think also, they're called the social emotions. I kind of ran through the list a second ago: guilt, shame, embarrassment, and remorse. And they just do not have those. And so, I think not showing those on the right occasion, I would think, would be a very strong giveaway.
Yeah. The other thing, too, I have seen is that they can manufacture those emotions usually very early in a relationship. And so just because they're present maybe in date 1, 2, 3, or 5 doesn't necessarily mean that they're able to sustain that. I mean, does that seem like – I mean, I felt like – I had made a joke, but it was a very serious joke or observation, which was, there was an individual that I've had in my life that I knew about, and I felt like there was like a 24-month expiration date. Like for about 24 months, a lot of the behaviors could be misleading and could be able to keep everybody kind of in the dark, but then eventually there would be a breakdown and some of the things would start to, dissolve. Either the narratives would begin to change, and then you're like, well, wait a second, just 2 years ago it was like this and now you're trying to tell me it's like this. Or they were just unable, the charm just couldn't sustain itself any longer and you started to see some of the cracks. Do you think that there's a timeline borderline, you know, psychopaths, do they have a breakdown, at which case you might be able to see something like this, you know, some of their deficiencies begin to emerge?
That's a very interesting idea. It kind of reminds me, since I'm on a car trip with a friend right now, the way that the ultimate test of a friendship is, can you go on a long car trip with them and be together for that long? And, you know, because you can only sort of fake it for so long. And I would think doing something like that would work. And this brings us back to the notion of responsibility again, because if a person is clever enough and in control enough to fake it for that long, that, you know, that means that they do know what they're doing. In the literature, there's a rough distinction between successful and unsuccessful psychopaths. Again, very rough, because the core of the distinction is just that the unsuccessful ones are entangled in the legal system in some way or other. And so they tend to be the ones who are less clever, less adept at hiding it. They often, you know, get into fights in bars. They're just unable to control their temper, wind up getting arrested, you know, wind up behaving poorly in prison and being kept there for longer periods. They, I guess, tend to be less dangerous to us regular folks, but the dangerous ones are the clever ones, you know, the CEOs who don't care who their products hurt and things like that. But yeah, your idea of a shelf life, I think, is interesting. It probably varies person by person. But I bet, yeah, if you spend enough time with them, if you listen long enough, it would start to creep out.
Well, so if you're trying to actually make a diagnosis or a determination, you know, I had found that there seems to be a couple of lists or things that professionals will actually use to make this official determination. I mean, it's easy for me, you know, layperson using the internet, to make my own diagnosis, but that's not accurate, nor is that legally binding. So if you have an entanglement with somebody that you're concerned would be considered a psychopath, how does that happen that somebody sits down and says, yes, this person is officially meets this criteria? And, you know, what does that look like?
Yes, the kind of the official standard these days, which almost no one is completely happy with, is called the Psychopathy Checklist Revised, 20 questions that are intended to get at the core criteria. And you either score 2, 1, or 0 on those questions. And if you score 40, you're the worst psychopath in the world. And I think your average psychopath is going to score around 30 or a bit higher on it. One thing that people are not quite so satisfied with is that this idea, do they have to have overtly done evil stuff? It brings up the interesting notion of someone who might be a psychopath in hiding. You know, they don't have empathy. They are a danger to you, but it's just the situation just has not come up yet. For instance, the kind of male psychopath who allies himself with a woman, takes everything she's got, disappears, moves on to the next woman. You know, that might not really hit the fan until he actually disappears with all your money. So it's not clear to me that we couldn't, say, diagnose a psychopath just by looking at their brain without regard to their behavior, because their brain, which has certain characteristics, for instance, this inability to integrate emotions such as empathy into normal cognition. You know, I think if you saw that, you realize that you're dealing with a potentially dangerous person, even though they might not have shown it yet.
So is there evidence of whether or not psychopathy is nature versus nurture?
There is evidence. Yeah, one really good, the gold standard is twin studies. And so you've got, identical twins, fraternal twins, either raised together or apart. And what you're looking for is a rising curve showing that identical twins, if one of them is a psychopath, identical twins raised together, if one of them is a psychopath, the odds that the other is a psychopath will be high, and then it goes down from there. Another sort of informal clue is that families, there are many cases of families where, you know, there's 3 or 4 kids. One of the kids is a psychopath. The others are just wonderful, completely, you know, well-formed people, which shows that it's not really upbringing that much. I'm sure upbringing could exacerbate it, you know, especially if it was abusive. But there's definitely something genetic going on there.
So is, you know, some of the subjects or some of the core features of it, and you've touched on a few of them, and I have a list for everybody that's listening here, from an article that Bill had written here, you know, uncaring, shallow emotions, irresponsibility, insincere speech, overconfidence, narrowing of attention, selfishness, inability to plan for the future, and violence is kind of being some of those core features. Now, some of those overlap also into a very popular term, you know, that a lot of people are also kind of throwing around as a label on a lot of, you know, exes that they don't like, which is narcissism. And so is psychopathy and narcissism one and the same, or are they two sides of the same, of different coins, or, you know, how did those two things relate together? I mean, can somebody be psychopathic and not be narcissistic, and vice versa?
I think there's a lot of overlap there. I suppose the narcissist might fit the concept I was talking about a second ago of a psychopath who hasn't really done anything horrible, but it's just a completely self-centered individual and is sort of, you know, unable to take your point of view, unable, for instance, in planning activities, unable to say, well, how, you know, how is this going to go for so-and-so? So let's see, to get at your question, can you be a psychopath and not be a narcissist? Perhaps not, because the characteristics of narcissism overlap so heavily with the core characteristics of psychopathy, you know, the selfishness, the egotism, the inability to, you know, build others into their planning and things like that.
Yeah. And so can we talk, because I know I want to get into the topic of responsibility, because that's a big meaty piece here. Mm-hmm. And before we go down onto that path there, why is it important to be able to assign a label to somebody or a diagnosis to somebody of psychopathy? Or is it important, you know, if you're dealing with certain people in your life that are exhibiting some of these characteristics that, you know, we just kind of ran through here, or these traits that we ran through here, you know, is it just to satisfy our curiosity, or are there some legitimate implications from being able to say and label or diagnose a person as being psychopathic? And I guess I mean that maybe from a legal standpoint, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's really important. Of course, there's always the danger of overdiagnosis, like the current issue with a possible overdiagnosis of autism. It's not clear what exactly is going on with that, but, you know, it's just so important to get clear on what's going on with these people and to diagnose them. I mean, it could be that what we're dealing with is not a unified disorder. I mean, perhaps there's four different types of psychopaths, and we'll have to get clear on that. I do, my hope is that as the brain science gets more clear, we'll be able to kind of separate. For instance, somebody who doesn't feel empathy at all versus somebody who feels empathy but doesn't attach any weight to it. You know, those might well be two different types of psychopaths. But, you know, and I think for the people themselves, that now we're getting, again, more into responsibility. But the idea that, if this is genetic, if the person can't help it, you know, that would seem to reduce their culpability to some degree. The problem is, I think that, you know, when you're an adult and you have copious evidence that you're causing a lot of harm to people, that you are responsible for fixing that. And if you don't do that, you can be held responsible to the fullest extent of the law. And that seems to be the best way, seems to me to be the best way to proceed there.
Now, so let's talk about this, because if we're talking about psychopathy as a physiological brain disorder, you know, the nature part here, then we start getting into this gray area, which I think becomes like a huge leap for people, which is the accountability, and especially from a legally speaking standpoint, for punishing and handing out consequences to someone who's psychopathic for their actions and behaviors. But what if they absolutely have no control over all of those things, then, you know, like, I think this is what you're talking about in your last, in your latest book here is, you know, where's that line between holding somebody accountable, you know, for something maybe that is truly beyond their control. But, can a psychopath ever take responsibility for their actions? I mean, will they ever truly take responsibility for them, I guess?
Yeah, I think control is the crucial thing. Culpability varies with level of control. But the thing is, psychopaths have that control, especially the more intelligent, the so-called successful ones, which haven't been apprehended and and might have, you know, relatively high positions in society, that it's clear that they know what's going wrong. They know they're harming people. And if they choose not to do anything about it, then they're fully culpable. In the book, we talk about the case of a kid who's raised by, you know, neo-Nazi parents. And so he doesn't know that it's wrong, that it's a bad worldview. So if he's 15 years old and he does something wrong, well, maybe we hold him considerably less responsible. But if he's 25 years old and he still holds those beliefs and acts on them, then we argue that he's fully responsible because, you know, the line between adulthood and adolescence is rough, somewhere between 18 and 21, but society absolutely has to have a line like that. And that's one function of the line. You know, it's a line in the sand. It's not the same for everybody, but society has to be able to hold people responsible. And the age is somewhat arbitrary, but it's got to be done.
Yeah. And so, you know, I guess that lends that question of, you know, will there be, do you see any changes in our viewpoint of all of that? Because I know that, like, in Washington State, you know, the legislators and the folks involved in the legal system really started to take another look at, you know, whether or not it was appropriate anymore to hold children and try children as adults for certain crimes because of this recognition, again, of brain architecture and neurodevelopment and things like that. And so do you think that there's a possibility in the legal system as this, you know, more of this evidence comes out about psychopathy and other, you know, mental health conditions like this that are, you know, that may be found to be much more rooted in genetics and DNA as opposed to, or even, I'll even say this, even your experiences growing up are relevant and germane because they do have a physiological impact on our body where somebody then, the consequences will change for them. You know, this, the accountability shifts a little bit. Like, how do you handle, you know, how would you handle somebody in the future that has stolen money from somebody, injured somebody, but then it's concluded that, you know, their physiology has been impacted on that, you know, I can see laws being rewritten, right? Or at least a justice system that actually changes to some extent. But I feel like from a philosophical standpoint, that'll leave an awful lot of people feeling like they never got justice served, right? So that, there is that balance, right? So what do you think ends up happening for us?
Yeah. You know, one thing we would like to see, I'm referring to my co-authors, Katrina Sifford and Tyler Fagan, is a legal system with more gradations of punishment, you know, rather than have these huge rough cuts where you either get probation or 10 years in one of our torture chamber prisons, which is, again, another factor in treating juveniles as adults. But you know, have all sorts of gradations based on what you know about the person's behavior and really what you know about their brain. You know, perhaps one of the first steps we could take is if we find someone has a sort of a fundamentally psychopathic brain, offer them the choice of voluntarily accepting some sort of medical treatment, medical procedure, medication, whatever. You know, do they want to do that? The case of involuntarily is, you know, much more complicated. And I personally would be reluctant to go in that direction. But, you know, it's possible with technology we can actually avoid this sort of nightmare scenarios where we're, you know, where it looks like we're forcing somebody to undergo a lobotomy or something like that. You know, it's possible that there could be medications that could remedy the situation. You know, and in the case of juveniles, the sooner you know that you're dealing with someone like that, the sooner you can hopefully sit them on a developmental course that will make them a regular, decent, functioning adult.
Mm-hmm. You know, and you bring up something that has always been, and this has actually been a thought that's on my mind, especially when you're in the struggle with somebody for whatever reason it might be, is this idea of, you know, somebody who is exhibiting these psychopathic behaviors, they're not going to willingly go through an evaluation or a diagnosis, mm-hmm. you know, and so you're left with this gray area of, you know, how do you compel somebody, you know, because if it's relevant to your to your position, that to identify, like, this is the condition I'm dealing with here, is that this individual over here is, you know, has a mental health condition that is impairing this ability to, you know, fix or resolve a solution. You can't force somebody, you know, you can't show up to, you know, a trial and make somebody go through an evaluation. You know, I mean, there isn't a moral objection to that, right? And and so then you're kind of stuck in this whole, we can only speculate as to whether or not that person's condition is such. But if you knew, you know, that, listen, these are going to be the definite areas that we're never going to get satisfaction out of. This person's always going to behave in this way, and we can't keep pretending like they won't, and trying to use the old applied techniques to that person when we know we need to be able to shift, but we're kind of left without that ability to do that, without having a diagnosis for us to help us out. And I think with the psychopath, we will run into that more often, right?
I think so. Yeah. And you know, one problem with the PCL, with a sort of question and answer inventory, is that if you're dealing with someone who's very clever and probably has a pretty good idea as to what's going on, they might well be able to fake it in a case like that.
And I was wondering about that, was whether or not, you know, if, you know, how accurate that type of an examination would be with somebody who's a psychopath. Is that, can they actually trick it? You know, like you had mentioned earlier in the interview, hopefully people caught that. The pathology behind the lie is that there's no, you know, they say it with complete conviction and truth. And so their nervous system doesn't show that they're hiding it. So they're going to pass a lie detector test, quite possibly. Same thing with like the PCL, like if they know that they're getting sat down to be examined with the purpose of determining whether or not they're, you know, a psychopath or sociopath, they might know how to create the right answers, and you never really get a good answer there. So are there protections in the examinations that can help inhibit the ability to trick the test?
Well, I think one thing you can do is sort of give them the test on more than one occasion, mix up the questions and things like that. And so that if there's inconsistency there, it's a clue they might be trying to trick you. But other than that, yeah, I think, you know, it is prone to being abused by a clever liar. You know, the person's got to sort of descriptively answer the question, which I guess would require fancier lying. But of course, many of them are quite capable of doing that. In the courtroom situation, I suppose you could give them a choice between some kind of remedial treatment and a longer prison sentence, which might get their attention. You know, we're all familiar with a history of horrible abuses in this realm. I mentioned lobotomy, but, you know, the fact that in the early phases of a kind of treatment, there were abuses doesn't mean that it can't be effective once we figure out what's going on. For instance, in the case of lobotomy, there actually is an ancestor of that operation that's used on people with extremely severe obsessive compulsive disorder, you know, who literally want to wash their hands all day long. It's a very focal brain operation called subcaudate tractotomy that works great. It completely liberates them from their obsessive behaviors, and they're able to get on with their lives. So, you know, we don't want to rule out prematurely medical interventions just because of the gory history. You know, we've just got to get it right. We've got to get the science right.
Yeah. You know, it seems though, you know, and I was sitting there thinking to myself, again, I'm excited to have a philosopher on the show, because this is you know, the questions are a little bit different for me and the thoughts are a little bit different. But, you know, when we're talking about somebody who has obsessive compulsive behavior, you know, sometimes it's very apparent that there's a downside to that. Like there's, you know, the upside isn't as much as the downside is. But with psychopaths, you know, they're living a life where there's always an upside, right? That their outcome always seems to be reinforcing their behavior, because it always seems to be working out for them, whether it really is or not. You know, so convincing a psychopath for treatment, it almost seems counterintuitive. Like it, you know, it's like we would force treatment onto somebody because it helped the rest of us. But for a psychopath to ever understand that it would actually help them, when all they've seen their whole life in their own view of the world is a complete upside to them. They've gotten everything they've wanted. They've been able to manipulate the circumstances, the people, the situations, you know, whatever it is. Is that a wrong assessment on my side, or a wrong viewpoint there, or different viewpoint?
I think that's a great point. Yeah. Because it's a successful strategy. And I think that's one reason why it's in our genes. It works. You know, they're able to attract male psychopaths, are able to attract mates. They're able to reproduce, which keeps it in the, you know, genetic pool. Yeah, so you're trying to convince them to go against what's worked for them their whole lives. And I could, maybe this is just one of those cases where society's got to put its foot down and say, we're just not going to let you keep acting this way. Or if you're going to keep acting this way, we're going to isolate you in some way or other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's probably, I would say, the hardest thing, because again, with an absence of being able to have some certainty about who they really are and who they are around us. Again, I go back to, that's the frightening aspect of all of this. You know, somebody threw out a number to me about what they believed in terms of the population, how many people out there would be considered or diagnosed as a psychopath. Is there a number or a guesstimate that you're aware of on what percent of the population might fall within this realm?
You know, I've seen some numbers. I'm kind of skeptical of the attempt to do it with the whole population, but, you know, the prison population is sort of easier to work with and measure. And there are figures of something like 20 or 30% of the prison population being psychopathic that I think might be a bit more accurate. You raised another interesting point, though, you know, getting back to this issue of trying to get them to change their whole lifestyle. Maybe one way to do that is to sort of help them, you know, pioneer a new lifestyle. They've got to work at a new way of interacting with people that they will eventually find more rewarding. And so that this is sort of treating it, instead of giving them a drug or an operation or something, this, I think, respects their personal autonomy a lot better. Again, you've got to get them to make the choice to do that, but, I guess there are ways to apply subtle pressure to make that happen, like threats of criminal punishment.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm smiling. You can't see that through the phone. But, you know, I have been made aware, let's just put it this way, that once you do know these things about people around you and you are able to identify, you know, what their core drives and behaviors are, more than they realize, you are able to do that. You are able to sometimes nudge them when you know, what's really motivating them and what their reasoning is, even if it's flawed. And so I would say it's manipulation in return, you know, to be honest.
That's right. But fair enough.
Because you can't be direct. You can't be confrontational. Because it just kind of pushes, you know, the wrong buttons for them. And so you almost have to be insidious on your own. You have to identify. And it was a conversation I was actually having with a friend last night about, you know, all of us sharing some overlap of some of these characteristics. It's where we land on a spectrum, right? And whether or not maybe empathy is the anchor that keeps us from going too far one way or the other with this. But if you're willing to be manipulative in return for the greater good of society, right, and for, you know, the benefit, and of course here we can open up another philosophical can of worms. Who gets to decide what's the greater good of society, right? But if you're able to, you know, if you're able to nudge psychopaths in the direction you want them to go, playing off of what they value, which is the control, the manipulation, the power, you know, the all the multitudes of things that that they need to have, then yeah, maybe you can actually, somebody had mentioned, you know, put them all on an island by themselves and let them all, you know, do their thing.
Yeah, right.
Oh.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one thing that's going to help them a lot is get them just to think more about what they're doing. You know, it's a great shame that when we put people in prison, they think less rather than more. It's just this numbing routine where I think they spend, you know, half the time sleeping and the other half the time in fear. Of course, not the psychopaths. They were probably more comfortable in prison. But the brain has a network based mainly in the prefrontal lobes called the executive system, a system of executive functions, including things like decision-making, planning, switching from one task to another, which psychopaths have trouble with. Instead of, you know, locking them up and warehousing them, put them in a situation where they have to think and make decisions. our local sheriff in Chicago, who's in charge of the Cook County Jail, Tom Dart, has been trying to do that. He has prisoners, raising animals. He had prisoners start a business in the prison where they made pizzas and sold them to other prisoners. But, you know, get them to start thinking more about what they do. Get them to, you might have to sort of guide their thinking process to get them to consider others in their plans, you know, just attach more weight to other people so that then when they get out, you know, they've at least got a chance to start living a new way.
It's, and it seems though, a big shift from when we talk about the selfishness, you know, it's in business, it's growth mindset versus fixed mindset, right? So a growth mindset is accountability. Mm-hmm. It is being able to take action and know where our responsibility lies within that, either when it's success or in its failures. Whereas chronically with psychopaths, there doesn't seem to be any accountability or responsibility. It's always somebody else's fault. It's always somebody else's problem,
yes.
You know? And so, you know, and I've heard, you know, and again, just in the realm of everybody's theories out there is that, you know, you are kind of one or the other. And so I think what you're suggesting is there a way that we can actually, you know, possibly shift somebody from that fixed mindset of everything's external to me, my external locus of control versus that internal locus of control. And it sounds like a great idea. I know that personally with me, with working with somebody and being with somebody, I was always hoping that could always be the case and was frustrated that that was not an inevitability. Because it just seems like it's, you know, it's ground in some way. And if research is showing that we're talking about really its brain structure, I mean, like its DNA, it's, you know, pre-birth. And then on top of that, exacerbated by environmental factors with childhood and other things that loop into mm-hmm. it. I don't want to sound like a fatalist, but it sounds like sometimes there, you know, there may be genuinely lost causes out there.
Could well be, but yeah, I think we need to keep the doors open there and hope for more effective techniques in the future. And again, I do like the idea in doing this, you are respecting the person's autonomy. Mm-hmm. It, you know, because if you perform an operation on them, that's sort of an unconscious thing that is not happening in the realm of their conscious cognition. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't, but better to try this first, have them voluntarily try to sort of realign their thinking in a more socially favorable manner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the moral question, right? We all get our choice, right? You know, I think that's one of the dilemmas that we've always had is to remove choices away from people because our perceptions of right and wrong change through history and through culture. And so a choice we might make for somebody today based on what we believe is the moral choice today could, you know, I mean, gosh, think about all the times we've made really terrible choices for people on the basis of morality and that we wish we could take back that we can't. So as long as we all have our autonomy, you know, it feels like then we're never going to be really subjected to somebody else's moral leanings, you know, that may change in 100 years or 20 years. So.
Yes. You know, and I think another factor that's making this whole process more difficult, by process, I mean, you know, the whole endeavor to get psychopaths to behave more socially is that the internet, you know, the internet provides a means by which someone can hide, right? There's a phenomenon I call sociopathic software, right? You go to a website, you're just cruising around, you're trying to get some information, but immediately the website software is getting every bit of information it can about you and trying to use it to make more money. You know, so the internet is a Disneyland for psychopaths in that they can completely hide their intentions. They can hide what they're doing. They can hide their identity. And it's very difficult for us to get through that. So it's not really helping the situation.
Oh, yeah. Social media, definitely, because you can always put out there a narrative you want everybody else to see. And then the truth, you know, of what goes on behind closed doors is, you know, unless there's cameras set up in your house, nobody ever really knows that, which is one of the frustrating and, I would say heartbreaking aspects of domestic violence and in particular with emotional abuse, because psychopaths do a really good job of putting out a false front, and social media can certainly, you know, not only be a tool to be able to put that false front out there, but then the psychopath can get confirmation of that falsity by how many likes they get and how many comments they get, you know, and it shores up their own perception of whether or not they really are doing something right or wrong. And while, you know, somebody is being abused and has to see that, which then is, you know, firmer, more confirming for them that they're lost, you know, and that they're trapped because too many people are giving, you know, and I've said that this last week many times, is that, you know, giving the abuser, you know, all the power, you know, and somebody who's a victim being sat there having to watch that play out in front of them, you know, through social media. Very painful.
And for the psychopath, if you get caught, if you get found out, just move to the next website.
Yeah, right. Shut your account down, move on, go to something else, put up another post that says, no, that's not what I meant, you know, and just kind of keep going. Yep. Oh, just my gosh.
Like, I guess in the old days, they would have to leave town and move to another town, but you don't have to do that anymore.
Nope. You can just steal somebody else's identity too, if you want to, I suppose. Oh my gosh. Well, so I want to start to wrap this up and kind of, you know, draw some conclusion here to this. You know, this is a fascinating topic to understand. Well, to attempt to understand, let's be fair here. The work that you've been doing and the research in it, I think is just, I mean, it's deep stuff. So anybody that, you know, is looking for some good sound bites and nuggets to take home and, you know, to coach themselves through that self-therapy and self-help, this isn't this. This is really kind of like to get in and understand, especially for people that have experienced individuals like this. You know, the stuff that you've been working on in the books that you've written in, and I think are really great for people that really want to try to really dive into it and understanding the brain in this concept here, you know, and to have your own philosophical discussions with your friends with beers and wine, you know, later. And so I appreciate you coming in to kind of touch on this topic with me. Is there something that you would throw into this conversation before we wrap it up that's important for the layperson to understand about psychopathy and how it may be impacting them and what they can do about that today in their life?
You know, I think we've hit most of the high points. I think I mentioned to you before we went on air about it might be good for everybody, I don't know, in the 9th or 10th grade to have a little course on what a psychopath or sociopath is and some of the ways you can detect them and how to disentangle yourself from them, you know, wouldn't hurt.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's just, you know, the realization that they are there. They are around us in some shape or form. They can be extremely dangerous to us, not just from a financial standpoint and emotional standpoint, but some of them do end up going, you know, further down that spectrum into violence, and they can be dangerous to us in that regard. And then, like you said, you know, I don't mean to scare everybody, but sometimes the psychopath is there around you and, you know, the circumstances have to be right in order to actually see the full breadth of what their capabilities are. And, you know, nobody wants to, you know, unfortunately be in the situation where they finally find out exactly how deeply, you know, how deep this might be for a certain person. And so knowing a little bit about what some of the highlights are, what I'm going to do is, for everybody that's listening, is Bill has written several really great articles about psychopathy on Psychology Today. And I'm going to include links to those articles that he's written as well, so that if you want to go into the subject matter a little bit more and get some good, you know, a good list of things to look for, to definitely go read those. Highly recommend them. And so I will have those links in the podcast notes. So, Bill, thank you again. This has been a fantastic conversation. I know offline before we started that I said we could go probably very long on a couple of these topics and really dig in, but the fact that you came in and were able to, you know, kind of give us the you know, kind of the top level conversation about this is really fantastic, and I appreciate your time so much.
Very good talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiaquiracone.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quiracone, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.